This is Directional, a podcast about video games and the creative rebellion. With Chantal Ryan and Jörg Tittle.
Chantal, it's 2024.
Sorry, who are you?
Oh, I'm the ghost from, you know, whatever remains of the video game industry.
Oh, yeah, I remember you.
Who are you again? It's been a while.
I barely remember myself. I am founder of the video game studio We Have Always Lived in the Forest, currently lead developer of the video game Dark Web Streamer, and your resident anthropologist. And who are you, Jörg?
That's a very good question. I struggle with that concept every day, but I run a company, sort of. I don't know if I'm running anything. Called Rapid Eye Movers here in London. And I've been a film director and producer. I've written graphic novels. I've worked as a video game journalist. But now we have a game called C-Smash VRS that was released last year. It's coming to Meta Quest 2, 3, and Pro on 4th of April, and also to the Pico 4 headsets. It was a Golden Joystick nominee last year for Best VR Game. It was Digital Foundry's VR Game of the Year, and now it's going to get even better and more exciting. And I don't know, just make things. You know, there's lots of stuff going on, but I mean, we're not here to talk about our work. We're here to talk about being rebels and creatives in a very strange and beautiful world. And we're back.
We're back, baby. How's your 2024 been?
Well, my 2024 has felt so far like a whole year compressed into a couple of months. And it's been really intense. I think because everyone here is still playing catch up with the reality that's hit us and that everyone was pretending wasn't there. Everyone just kind of thought, oh, it's Embracer is the problem, you know? And it's like, I wish it was just this one dude, you know, wishing for Saudi money that, you know, ruined everything for a few companies. No, everyone was that Embracer group. They all did the death embrace all at the same time. It's just that Embracer was a really sort of convenient, you know, one to blame. Because it was so obvious what their mistakes were. But it's really interesting because, like, on the day that Embracer had finally sort of laid off like their 1,400th employee or something, on the same day, Microsoft announced that they were laying off 2,000 in one go. So, but no one sort of talked about that. It's like, oh, sure, you know, Microsoft's a large company, so of course, it's natural for them to just get rid of a couple of thousand. I was like, oh, but that's more than Embracer in one day. And Embracer has been doing this over a year.
Embracer.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Difference.
Yes. Yes. You know, it is all hateful. That's the problem. It's like, but at the same time, and this is the horrible reality to me. Well, we'll get to that probably. But we kind of saw it coming, though, didn't we?
I mean, it depends how you define saw it coming. How do you define it, Jörg?
Well, I don't know. I mean, last year I was on stage at Reboot Develop Blue in Croatia, and I tried to warn people that this reality in which we're all being reduced to spermatozoids vying for attention and not even being regarded as a fully formed life form by any of these platforms, that was unsustainable and that they were crushing us. And while they're crushing us, they're also crushing the one thing that lifts them up. And so that imbalance, which is what they call content, but it isn't content. I mean, we make games, and we make the stuff that gives them a reason to exist. If we don't make games that get to stand on top of these platforms and actually shine and delight audiences and make them, you know, experience things they've never experienced before, make them feel good, make them feel scared, make them feel loved, whatever it may be. If we don't get to do that, if we don't get appreciated and embraced for the work that we do, then they will collapse, you know. And that's what's happening, unfortunately, for them.
I was there, and you did indeed stand on a stage and say exactly that. I was your witness, as was a room full of half-inspired and half-horrified game developers. You know, some people agreed with you and some did not, as you stood there talking about the state of the industry and the fact that we were day by day being reduced to artless, is how I would phrase it. We have been relegated to labor vessels, not creatives, not artists, but kind of these, you know, occasionally talking arms and legs who perform the gestures of creation that allow some semblance of something that looks like a video game to make it to market, to ultimately, hopefully, make the companies a fuck ton of money. You know, who the developers are on the creative end of that seems to have been quite an afterthought, if a thought at all. I'd probably lean towards the latter. What art means has been largely forgotten by the people up here. We have seen, you know, video games have been, the word game is in the name. The concept of a game is something that brings joy and a sense of playfulness and inspires imagination. And that has been, I don't know if sacrificed is the right word, because sacrifice implies intentionality. I don't think there was intentionality in the, you know, the abortion of creativity and joy in the ultimate direction of these video game projects. I think that, you know, people who run these companies that fund video games are looking at these games like products. They are looking at them from purely numbers directions. And I know I'm not saying anything that people don't know and haven't surmised on their own, but it's really important that we articulate, you know, very clearly what the issue is. And that's that people who are in charge of major decisions, both in what games make it into our hands and what games we get to work on, are fundamentally assessed by marketability and profitability. And when we have those people who are making decisions based on that, and, you know, this is something we actually explored quite a bit in our interview with Luke Bernard, the wrong people are making the decisions here. They're not just the wrong people and the wrong decisions. The metrics by which video games are being assessed as viable are all off. There are not like joy metrics going on. There are exploitation metrics instead being assessed against the viability of these projects and the fundability. We're seeing games as a service, that conversation going on a lot right now. And fundamentally what that is, you know, how psychologically exploitable is this game in regard to the players?
If you go into the semantics of games and the people who make them, then there are a few words that are problematic. Like, one is the word developer. if you think about someone who's at a developmental stage or a child or a person, then they aren't fully formed yet. So technically what you are doing as a developer, you're doing the Sisyphean job where you're always just trying to get something somewhere, but you're not actually the person that actually finishes anything. You are just a cog in the wheel. You're a hamster that's constantly just developing. Oh, they're just in development. But then you have creators, content creators. They're the ones who make something tangible. So the people who are making games are less final in what they create and what they make than the ones that consume it for attention. And so that's one sort of undermining factor. Then we also have the idea of us constantly talking about the game industry. You know, as we had earlier in the chat before we started recording, you said, you know, we don't call it the book industry, right? I mean, we can. But, or the painting industry.
We don't call books products.
You know, maybe some sort of publisher in their sort of third quarter sort of shareholder meeting might refer to them as products, but we don't have to listen to that garbage. That's their problem. But when the consumer starts thinking of, and the players, more importantly, and I just call them consumers.
Insidious, see the ghost of the industry speaks.
It's awful. I mean, like, I remember a moment that really changed me and really was quite intense was a few years ago in London. I was on a bus and there were a couple of like 8-year-old kids who were talking like, oh, have you seen this new Disney IP?
Oh, and I'm no.
Like, what the fuck? IP? Yes, kids. No. IP. I mean, those kids had barely stopped peeing in their own diapers, and they were using that dumbass term. But it
pains
awful.
Me today. You know, talking about RIP is such a horribly reductive term. Like, you know, I know it's normalized to talk about like Lord of the Rings as IP today, but there was a time not that long ago where, you know, you'd be looked at if you had two heads, if you're like, yes, the Lord of the Rings IP is one of my favorite IPs. It's like, no, how dare you disgrace the, you know, the art of Lord of the Rings.
Yeah, I mean, so that's an issue. And then the industry thing is a problem. And I understand it because as games have become the mainstream, you know, the need for more of them to exist became felt by the people with money and who see, you know, who are driven by greed rather than by expression. I understand that. And I understand how you then want to sort of put all those developers instead of hamster wheels, you put them on conveyor belts and you have them sort of running around on those conveyor belts, sort of endlessly going, have to ship this game, have to add more content on top. And that's been sort of going on sort of for, you know, on a massive scale. And it's crazy because you suddenly have these AAA games now that are trying to play catch up with the hardware. Hardware that we hope can last for 8 years, but it doesn't anymore because the hardware is coming on so quickly. And so suddenly you've got sort of standalone VR headsets able to match a console from 2 years ago and it's running on an Android chip and going, oh, the fuck, oh my God. And now the console at home looks like shit. Oh my God, we have to stream everything now in order for everything to look, ah! And so we've been doing this for a while. And those games take 5, 6, 7 years to make now because they're so fucking enormous. Unless you have teams of like 500 people. Oh, wait, no, let's get 500 people. Let's make that in 4 years. Let's make it in 3.
They still take that long.
And then they take forever. And then the pandemic happens. They realize, oh, it's fine. It'll be fast once the pandemic goes over. And in the meantime, people have realized, oh, my God, but we can't work at this level because it's fucked up. We have to live a little bit. We have some demands. You know, you can't exploit us. We can't just be in fucking, you know, rooms like maybe to sleep in the office where we might actually get molested by fellow co-workers, etc., which has also been happening a lot over the last couple of years. Yep. So this is just not sustainable. And it was really interesting. I was in a call yesterday with lovely people talking about sustainability in games and talking about doing things for the environment as the game industry in the game industry. And you'll be hearing more about that later in the year. But what was really interesting at the beginning of this call, like amazing top developers who sold millions of games over the last few years and across mobile and consoles and everything. And on that call, I said, like, it's well and good for us to talk about sustainable, like, methods of making games or being good to the environment. But one thing I've realized with personal experience the last couple of years is that it doesn't matter how highfalutin your opinions about how the world should be a better place are. If you don't make changes at home, if you don't actually make changes with your own body, if you don't actually treat your body like a planet that requires, that sort of deserves to be taken care of, then how are you going to fix anything in the outside? Like, the change happens at home. It happens with you.
Your body is a temple.
It is. It is. But it's like, but it is the thing that is like, I when my dad passed away a few years ago, and I went through a really dark time, and I went to see a shrink, and trying to figure out how the fuck to get out of this like spiral of, anxiety attacks and panic attacks and depression and everything else. And at the end of like 6 sessions or so, he finally said to me, "I have figured out, I think. Well, you have figured out because you've been saying it, Jörg, but we're there. I think we understand what the issue is. The issue is your circle of concern is far bigger than your circle of influence." And that doesn't mean that you should not be concerned about these larger things. But what we need to do is you need to be aware and understand what your circle of influence is. And that requires to take things step by step and to make changes gradually, slowly, etc. And when you do that, when you only fix the things that you can change, like, it will have a ripple effect gradually.
Mm-hmm. The circle expands.
That's right.
That is fascinating because, a little longer than a few years ago, maybe 5, 6, before I actually enrolled in my degree, which is related to this story, I went through a very similar situation. I needed a big life change. I was running a photography company. I didn't believe in my life. I wasn't accomplishing meaningful things that I felt compelled to accomplish. I ended up closing that, and by that point I had spiraled into quite a depression. But during that depression, I started learning a lot about climate change. A war, and God, there's been so many wars since it is. I'm like, which war was that? The war in Syria. I was very deeply wrapped up in these very painful incidents, and I remember kind of like, I was on Facebook a lot, and I was typing out these posts, and I was talking in groups, and I was writing these essays, and I was getting into like arguments with people online, where I would show up with like an incredibly academically sourced 2,000 word rebuttal to some idiot on the internet. And the work I was doing in those moments were important, but my husband said something to me that was very similar to your therapist, and he said, "Chantal, you're spending so much time on like what is essentially a very small amount of people. You have important things to say, and you have the power to change things, but you need a bigger platform. You need to stop spending your time focusing in on these smaller circles essentially. And you need to go out into the world, and you need to figure out a way to get the platform that you need in order to accomplish the changes that you clearly so desperately want." And I realized he was right. And it is the exact same. And, when I say I realized he was right, what I mean is it was a very profound moment for me. The level of right he was life-changing. And so it kind of aligns with you perfectly in that I was miserable because the circle I cared about was indeed so much larger than my circle of influence. And I'm noticing, as I show up with my work, and I know you're noticing the same thing, that circle of influence is expanding. We are, you and I have built something of our reputations on showing up and being very engaged and activistic and at times brutally honest with the people around us.
But I don't think we're brutal. I think we're just honest. I think the people that may see that as brutal is not our intent. And I think we just say what we mean, and we say it with respect to people actually not having a shit time. Like, and if that is brutal, I don't know, man. I mean, what is brutal is wars. Wars are brutal. What's brutal is people losing their fucking jobs, like in the thousands, you know. And for every person that loses their job that they thought was secure because of this sort of gaslighty industry term that's being sort of plastered all over the place. No, I mean, that's brutal. Like the fact that people are made to move, like countries, like states across America, et cetera, in order to relocate for a job and 3 months later be laid off. There has been so many stories like this. It is beyond brutal. It's inhuman.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, you make an excellent point. I think it's important to articulate this. We do live in a society where honesty is often compromised at the expense of keeping people feeling comfortable. And I think, you know, a lot of the problems that we see in society are, it's, you know, ultimately can be traced back to this: people who are misleading each other around their feelings or their intentions or experience they've had in order to avoid uncomfortable situations. And so, you know, you and I, we are very blunt people. It's something we bonded over. It is not uncommon for either of us to be standing in a group conversation and come out with something that kind of makes everyone stop talking for a moment as they go, wait, they really said that? But, you know, I agree. Like, I wouldn't call it brutal. I actually find total honesty an act of love. This is something I feel very, very strongly about. Mm-hmm. The people I trust most in the world are the people that I trust will say something to me that they know may hurt me deeply, but respect mm-hmm. me enough and have, you know, good enough intentions that they will tell me the truth because they want me to be able to make the best decision I can with all the information I can have available to me. Mm-hmm. And so I treat everybody else in the same way. I always show up with my most honest self because I genuinely believe that the world will be a better place with that kind of loving, brutal honesty.
I met a new friend couple of weeks ago, and we've been talking a lot. She's really awesome, and I had a coffee with her a couple of days ago, and she said to me that whenever she writes an email now, and she feels that she's writing in a businessy kind of tone, she deletes it immediately, and she changes it into, how would I say this as me? And so it's not just about being honest to others, it's also being honest to yourself. It's like, is this really how you would talk to a person? And if you do that, mm-hmm. if you're speaking the language, or if you're adopting the language of some sort of the, whether it's the patriarchy or the corporate world or whatever, you are gradually losing yourself and you're losing your intent within that. Surely at this point, we should all understand that, you know, the only thing that we all have in common is our difference, and we need to embrace that. And that's honesty. If you just say, like, this is who I am, I'm not making any apologies for it. I'm also not going to be arrogant about it. It's just me. Hear me out. Mm-hmm. Hear me out on this. I think what is exciting is right now, and I really think it's a very hopeful time for not the game industry. It's a shit time for the game industry. It's a shit time for any industry. I think it's an incredible time for people who want to dedicate their lives to expressing and making and sharing beautiful things. But that also requires an immense sense of dedication and courage, and it is not for everyone. That is one thing. It mm-hmm. is not a world that I would recommend everyone to jump into, because that's where the gold rush is. It's not a fucking gold rush because it's not about the gold. It's about other things.
Yeah, absolutely. I made a tweet, the important things. But I did, maybe yesterday, I talked about...
I saw it, yes.
Yeah, I'm like, are you referencing me right now, Yuck? But... I did. I made a tweet about how I've been withdrawing a lot of the mentoring I would traditionally be doing, because I do get asked quite often. And I don't want to make everything look like sunshine and roses right now. And the direct comparison I used for entering into the industry and trying to kind of make it in this industry was crawling over jagged glass. And that is not an exaggeration. I said that very intently. It is hard and painful and damaging. That's the stark truth of the matter. I know, you know, Yag, you and I are both game directors, developers, creators, we're CEOs. We, you know, it's our job to both get the funding as well as to design the game, as well as to, you know, make sure things are being executed to the vision. We have been struggling, you know, it's incredibly time consuming. We've had to sacrifice a lot of our lives, our time, our social lives, our, you know, our own finances. As if you can think of an arena in which you can sacrifice in your life, we've probably sacrificed for it. And I would say that is true of, you know, I wouldn't even say most founders or directors or whatever, but probably everyone in the games industry has made real, genuine sacrifices. And you know, that I don't want to say I don't think that's all bad, in that I want to condone an industry that is in its current form fundamentally exploitative, because it's not. But going back to the conversation about creatives, this, you know, the word game to me connotates art. It is something created in the pursuit of imagination and joy and expansion of experience.
The act of creation requires dedication and also a lot of sacrifice. That doesn't mean that you should allow the kings of industry to make you work for exposure. Because it's not about fucking exposure. It's not about attention. It's about doing things that you believe in. And if you don't believe in doing it, if you believe in doing it just because you think it's going to give you stability in life, whether it's financial stability or even emotional stability and stuff, I have to say it's not guaranteed. It's actually highly unlikely. And that's the problem of being an artist and a creative person. It requires a level of self-sacrifice. I'm not saying that we work harder than people in mines. We don't. Our level of self-sacrifice is far below that of risking our physical lives and actually our lungs, etc., in order to crawl through, you know, tunnels underground. That's not what we do. But it is not easy and it's not rosy, especially in the world where what our output has been reduced to digital content packs, you know, that are impossible to find on algorithmically uncurated sort of stores run by greedy people that take a third of the money for your lack of attention. It's gross, and it's not sustainable. But what I do love is that the current collapse and contraction that's happening is exactly parallel to what was happening to the film industry in the 1960s. And so I'll paint a very quick picture of that. I'll do it even better. A few days ago, here at BAFTA in London, the wonderful head of Final Fantasy, was Kitase-san, was on stage, and he was talking about the evolution of Final Fantasy over the years. And I think he joined Final Fantasy on with Final Fantasy III, I think he started, and he actually studied animation before that. He recalled that at the beginning of, so it was 1978, him and his dad went to see the first, the fourth, I guess, Star Wars film in Tokyo. And that was the happiest moment he's ever shared with his dad. He saw his dad smile from ear to ear, and they were like two boys, you know, having this incredible magical experience together. And a couple of weeks later, he was watching, he was playing Space Invaders at home. And he recalls his father entering the room and looking at him with disappointment and disinterest. And it really hurt him to see that in his father's face, because when he was playing that game, he experienced the same level of excitement and joy as he did when he was watching Star Wars with his dad. And so then he made it his mission to make games so mainstream and so larger than life and so cinematic that one day his father would like them too. And when you take a look at how Final Fantasy has evolved over the years from being this, you know, top-down game with a lot of abstractions and stuff with compressed time, etc., now they can expand Final Fantasy VII into these enormous games, you know, that require multiple sequels, etc., to be even remade into that. And you realize how much was compressed and done between the pixels, and now it's become more and more obvious, more and more literal in a way, but also more and more impressive. It's stunning what they're doing, right? But now it requires hundreds and hundreds of people to be made, billions of dollars, or I don't know how many yen, I can't even imagine the number, to make. But he, at the beginning of the talk, and unfortunately his father never lived to see the day, lived to see his son make Final Fantasy as exciting and, you know, visually stimulating, etc., as that Star Wars that they enjoyed together. What was interesting that at the beginning of his talk, he asked us all what our favorite, because he says he just likes to ask that question. He asked us what our favorite Star Wars trilogy was. Was it the original ones, 4, 5, 6, whatever, the Luke Skywalker one? Was it the prequels that George Lucas did later on with, you know, the Anakin story with, you know, the kid, etc.? And then, or is it the later ones, the, you know? And of course, we all clapped the loudest for the originals, the ones that didn't have VFX. They only had special effects, practical effects, etc. But, you know, it doesn't matter. They were the original ones. And of course, we all clapped the loudest. At the end, we had a Q&A, and I raised my hand, and, you know, I was there with a friend, and they said, like, Jörg, what the hell are you going to ask now? I'm like, don't worry, I'll make you proud. And and I said, you know, thank you so much for, because there were a bunch of other Final Fantasy fans that were there and like asking very specific, very Final Fantasy questions, which I didn't understand. But I asked him, you know, I said, like, first of all, it's amazing what you've done. I mean, you know, like, you know, he also directed Chrono Trigger, which is one of the greatest things ever made. And he's just awesome. But so I first of all said, you know, thank you for all the amazing work and this great talk, etc. What's really interesting is you started this talk talking about how you wanted to make games mainstream, and in order to please your dad, who sadly never lived to see the day. But you started it by asking us what our favorite Star Wars films were. And we all clapped for the originals. What's interesting is that when the Star Wars films came out, film was already the mainstream. It was the most watched, most consumed piece of entertainment and art in the world. And at the beginning of the 60s, 45 million people would watch movies in the US, go to the cinema, 45 million a week. And by the end of the 60s, that number went down to 16. And that's how quickly it collapsed. Because by the time the 60s rolled around, the studio system had become so efficient at churning these things out that the general public,
formulaic,
people said, fuck this, right? I'm just going to watch some color TV, I'm going to watch sports, whatever, right? Things were changing. And so, when it was on its last legs and on its knees, the industry, as perhaps we're starting to see now, oh, actually, no, it's exactly happening. There were, like, I would say in the US, there were like three guys. In this case, there were men, but also it was at a time when women weren't fucking pushed to the forefront and weren't allowed. That time has changed.
We weren't invited.
And technically, they invited themselves, but they had that privilege. So Steven Spielberg, for instance, literally just rented himself an office at Universal Studios on the lot And I think it was Universal. I forgot which one it was. And I just said, like, yeah, I'm a studio director now. I was like, this is not how it works. You have to be, you know, you have to go through all the fuck. You have to go with the system. You have to be part of the factory line. He's like, do I? I don't know. And then, and he just went and he started making films by handpicking talent from all those garbage factory line films. Ah, this guy looks really cool. I'm going to talk to him. Hey, do you want to make a movie? Yeah, which project have you been assigned to? None. I'm just making my own. It's like, really? Yeah. And so this is what he did. And then you had George Lucas. We all know what George Lucas did, etc. So there.
I do.
Well, Star Wars. that one. So I said to him, like, I said to Kitase-san, I said to him, like, do you think? And if we are indeed in the 1960s, equivalent of the video game industry right now, with 16,000 layoffs in a year, etc., do you think we're about to see the most exciting time? Do you think that now we're about to see the Jaws and the Star Wars and the Apocalypse Nows of video games? And he leaned back and he was like, oh, totemo omoshiroi desu ne. Like, it's really interesting, isn't it? He went, and the whole audience sort of, and it goes quiet for a few seconds, and the whole audience goes like, oh, the master is thinking, you know, the vibe was so cool. And then he sort of like summarized his entire talk, what he did. And at the end, he sort of leans back in his chair and he goes, you're right. I believe I achieved everything that I can achieve with Final Fantasy. And it's now the time for someone to make the Star Wars of video games. And I was like, fuck yeah. I like this. And that's where we are now. Like, now the platforms are down. The industry is in some sort of weird phase. And we cannot let them rebuild in their own image. It's not going to fucking work anymore. It's unsustainable. But what is sustainable is our ideas. And they can be larger than ever. They don't have to be more expensive, but they have to be bigger. They have to be better. They have to be more accessible. They have to be more universal. They have to be more inclusive. They have to be more fucking exciting. They have to be more video game than video games have ever been. We have to stop fucking copying the way movies look. We have to start shaping the way games should fucking feel. That's what we have to work on. And I think it's an incredible time and I love it.
And that's a summary. I deeply agree with everything you're saying. I have been reminded constantly lately of something called positive disintegration, the theory of positive disintegration. Mm-hmm. This was proposed by a Polish psychologist called Kazimierz Dąbrowski, mm-hmm. I believe. And he kind of developed this incredibly interesting, I don't know if I would call it a system, but sort of a breakdown summary of things that he observed about human beings after a decade or more of very close study. And he introduced the concept of these levels of positive disintegration that people go through. And what positive disintegration actually means is that he posited humans start at, say, something of a low level or merster. They kind of have these like base animal instincts, these simple awarenesses, these simple motivations. We want food, we want drink, we want safety, we want our base needs met. And that's kind of like our level of awareness that many of us operate on. But he posited that there are multiple levels of, personality development. And, you know, it's funny to use the word development given the discussion earlier. I'm actually going to pull up a summary of the levels right now so I don't miscategorize. But, you know, it goes from levels 1 up to 5. And basically, he posits 5 is more or less, I wouldn't say enlightenment, but he describes the highest level of, you know, this personality development as pure creative expression. You have gone through your base animal urges to kind of satisfy these basic needs, and you have ascended to think about philosophy and the plight of, you know, your fellow beings, and then you've ascended again to compassion and forgiveness and kind of a, you know, a more pro-social state of being that has kind of transcended your need to have fear and panic around your own needs. But the reason it's called positive disintegration, and the reason he has put it in a level system, is that he argues in order to move from one level to another, you go through a process called positive disintegration. And that means as you are moving from one sort of base state of existence and awareness to the next, you actually experience something of a crisis of existence. Mm-hmm. You know, people might call it an existential crisis, but there is a personality disintegration that takes place where you begin to realize that the things you valued, the things you arranged your life around, are actually not serving you anymore. And it can be very frightening and confronting. You can say, holy shit, what have I been working toward? What have I been like doing with my life? Like everything that I believe in is currently crumbling around me as I'm coming into these other beliefs and these other priorities that are, you know, causing me to second guess everything and causing me to essentially want to blow up my life and rebuild it from the ashes up. And so, you know, he says that in a lifetime, many people actually, you know, most people will never achieve level 5 of positive integration or disintegration, depending how you want to frame it. He says many people actually kind of get stuck around level 3. Can't really recall what level 3 is, but I encourage people to look it up because I found
we'll link to it in the notes for sure.
Yes, but I've really been feeling that I've been observing, I've over the years since I've read about this theory, I have clocked moments in both my life and my friends' lives where I am like, holy shit, like this is that thing. This is positive disintegration. I know you're in pain right now. I know it feels like everything's blowing up, but I see you building a better life for yourself. You're destroying everything around you in terms of, you know, maybe relationships or career, etc. But it's because you have a clearer idea of who you are today and what you want from your life. And it's painful to confront that you need to change everything. But, you know, ultimately, when you get past that destruction, you are going to emerge from all of that in a much, much better and more solid and stable and beautiful place. And so when I hear you talk about how, you know, the industry is crumbling, but this is actually a really powerful time for us all, I think about this is potentially the positive disintegration of the industry where it's collapsed under the weight of itself. We're having a moment of reckoning where we are like, this is an unsustainable life. This is an unsustainable mode of existence. And we need to like figure out what is it that is sustainable? What is it that, you know, not just gets our bills paid? To me, you know, it's an important issue, but as a creative, the money thing is way on the, I would not be running a video game studio, an indie studio, if money is something I cared about, by the way. But, you know, I believe this is the time of artists, just as you believe this is the time of artists. I think this is when we collectively redefine what the industry looks like, because we are the ones, you know, us little indies on the ground. And, you know, maybe AA studios, I have no idea how you're defining that. I'm just going to randomly pick a phrase there. We're the ones who are forced to build sustainable studios and games. We have the recipe. We've been forging it.
We do. I think, first of all, I think we have to go back to the idea of the circle of influence and versus the circle of concern. I can't change the industry. Like I don't have the power. I'm not at the very top of it. Going, this is what you're going to do now. So we have to start within our circle of influence, which is with the stuff that we do step by step every day. In terms of sustainability, you know, the idea of employing shitloads of people that sit around in cubicles and wait for crunch is probably not the way to make art anymore. You know, I'm glad we've tried that for a while. Glad you all enjoy the fucking tens and tens of hours of content that creates. But the misery that came with it, the families destroyed, you know, the businesses collapsed. You know, it's not going to work. So, I mean, for instance, I mean, the way, you know, I make games far more the way films started getting made, especially after the 60s, where, you know, I handpick a few hands-on core people. We get the games developed to the prototypes and the concept art and the concepts and the game design docs and everything to a high enough level. We can then team up with other developers or hire in as we need it. And everyone knows that we're working on this project. We're not full-time employees of the thing that whether they care about it or not, you know, are then just going to roll into the next one. You know, I don't wish I could do it because I hate managing people. First of all, I'm a terrible manager, and I'm an awful employee. You would never want to hire me. I'm completely unhirable. And so I thought,
that's why we run our companies. That's why people hate CEOs.
Can't do it. But also, I can't have anyone talking to me like I'm their boss. I can't do it. I don't get it. I don't, because I'm not, because I'm fucking useless at managing. So why the fuck should you treat me like some boring ass manager? I don't know. So I work with people, first of all. And then the other thing that I've realized, as opposed to people working for me or me working for others, I don't work for anyone. No one works for me.
Very important.
The other thing is I only work with people who make me smile. Only. If you don't do that, we're not right for each other. And that's it. And I have to make them smile in return. If I realize that I make someone miserable, we're obviously not meant to be. And I have to be honest to myself with that. I'm not the right person for them to work with. And therefore, we have to part ways. That's number two. Because the shit that we do will sometimes take 2-3 years or more. And then post-release, also we have to promote things together, etc. Those are long-term commitments. And if those people don't vibe, then everything collapses very, very quickly. This is not just in terms of making, but also in terms of selling, who's publishing it, etc. The other day, for instance, I was in a call with a company you also had a call with after I recommended you to them a few weeks ago, and they shall not be mentioned. But I had a call with with one of their people on the call, who had such a arrogant, dismissive, bored expression on his face, and also didn't do his homework, that a few minutes into the call, I said, you haven't done your homework, and you have a bored, dismissive, and arrogant expression on your face, where this just means that this meeting is over. And they went, what, you're not going to show us the playable and all the other thing you're doing? No, I don't think you should be the right people to even look at the game. And so I left the meeting.
Yeah, and some people would, like, I know the way some people would react to that as if you were making some kind of power move. But this is the thing about, you know, a word that I keep thinking about throughout this whole conversation is the word authenticity. We were talking about honesty earlier, and I think fundamentally what we mean when we say honesty is authenticity. Correct. And so we don't want to, you know, I'm just bundling myself in with you because I'm quite similar. We don't want to play a game. We don't want to do a big performance where we pretend that we're getting along and that we're not, you know, bothered by ways that people are interacting with us. We don't want to sit there for an hour with someone we already know is, you know, not our working style or we're not jiving with. The energy has to be there. And I actually think when you're doing, you know, really when you're doing anything, but particularly when we're talking about business where it involves stuff like contracts, it can be really dangerous to get in the habit of, you know, ignoring the energy exchanges and evaluations that you are having when you kind of, you have that moment of, ooh, this doesn't feel good, but then you try to rationalize it away. You don't want to be judgmental. I have never ever in my life had a positive experience come out of ignoring that gut energy interpretation. Mm-hmm. And so I think, you know, it's not a power move to be like, hey, you know what, we showed up and clearly the vibe is wrong. Another thing I actually want to hallmark here before we move on, as we do, is I'm going to get a little hippie on y'all now. I truly believe that the energy that we put into the things we make is felt and experienced and carried along to our players, to the people who experience the experiences that we make. So I believe fully, passionately, wholeheartedly in the fact that creating these things needs to be a joy. We need to put joyous energy into the games that we make, because they, I've seen this happen, you know, with my own game. I've seen just inexplicable joy when people play. And, you know, for me, I'm like, this is way too early. This game is too much of a shell for you guys to be getting nearly as excited or happy about it as you are right now. But what I do know is that when we were making the game, we were in a joy state. We were in an ecstatic creative state. And I see that weird transfer of ecstasy, you know, move into people, even on a busy ass, you know, incredibly crowded, loud PAX floor, it still shines. So when you say, you know, if someone's not vibing with me or I'm not vibing with them, I know that people who haven't necessarily worked in the same kind of long-term small teams that we work on might kind of be like, well, you know, you're not always gonna get along with your colleagues, so you just gotta get over it. You know, as we really look at ourselves as creatives and artists foremost, I feel the same way that you do about running a company, running a studio. I hate this shit. I genuinely do. I also don't want to manage people. I don't want to be a boss. I don't want someone to be my boss. I just want to show up and like make a kick-ass thing with a group of other really talented creatives. That's literally all I want. I hate contracts and money and funding and you know, the project management software. My God, who did this to us? But, you know, it's, I truly believe that the team and the vibe of creation, that like charisma that you have between each other, that ability to show up and just laugh because you all love each other. Like, you know, I won't say it's a family, but there needs to be this kind of fundamental love between each of the people that you are working with in order to create joy.
I'm into that. And man, I love when you go hippie on me. But it's interesting because with C-Smash VRS, our game that we released, our first game that we released is my company. was, you know, I wanted to make something that's, you know, really joyful and zen and relaxing at the edge of space and time, full body, alone or with another player, allow people to vibe and like move to beautiful music. And we celebrated that with like live concerts, with gigs, with, you know, with all this stuff run in order to really make people understand that this is a sort of, this is a physical thing. It's not just a game. It's a sort of lifestyle. And it was not about lifestyle and packaging and branded products. It was in terms of the events that we made around the event, and also reminding people that the game itself is an event. It's an expression of what we're really trying to do and say. And in the process of, and now I'm working on a game which I haven't announced yet, but I'm working on with a childhood hero, with one of the greatest developers in the world. And when we work together, we are like little children. And this is a gentleman who is quite a bit older than me and has achieved, you know, has pretty much invented, you know, half of the genres that we know in games today, etc. And there was this moment the other day when we were talking to a co-developer on the project and sort of like getting them sort of up to scratch with what we're doing and sort of getting on the same page, delightful people as well. And in the middle of this call, you know, at some point we were talking about what the, you know, the co-developer was asking questions about how does this work and how is this going to work and affect the gameplay, et cetera, et cetera. And so my childhood hero, who's now not working for me, but with me, he's starting to explain, he jumps on this and he goes like, it's going to be like this and whatever, and then this going to happen and that's going to happen and then da-da-da-da-da-da, and this is how the systems work together, et cetera, et cetera. And then he turns to me in the meeting and goes like, is this how you see it, Jörg? Is that the vision that you've had for it? And I went like, fuck. I was starting to cry in the middle of the meeting because there was someone without whom I would not be doing what I do now. It's also his fault that all the pain if we go through. but he did something that no previous co-developer or partner or anything had ever done to me. To check in with me and say, is this how you saw it? Not as a form of sort of being like under me, or not as a, because acknowledging that, you know, acknowledging everyone's bring something to something, and the respect and the lack of ego and all that kind of stuff. And when I realized, damn, I can get that from someone who has achieved fucking everything. And for him to have that level of respect shows that I can never give less than that to anyone else. I always have to treat everyone like this and better and more, and then some. And so this is just my call to everyone in this. Well, it's not a fucking industry, guys and girls and lads and people, and it is not a fucking industry. The only people that call it that are those that want us to be on conveyor belts. We make incredible, beautiful things. If we really have to, if you have the fire in you to do that, and fucking do it, but only do that with the best people, with the best intentions, treat each other with respect. Because it's so fucking impossibly hard, the one thing that we definitely not have any, no more room for now, is the bullies, the gaslighters, the fucking molesters, the assholes, it's gone. It's over because it's hard enough as is. So if anyone behaves like that, it's not about canceling them. Fuck them. Get rid of them. Like instantly. Like just, we don't need them.
Don't cancel them. Fuck them.
We don't need them. Like, I was talking to a bully on another project, I won't say what it is. A project I've been working on for years, and someone who's been a dick to a lot of people, and, you know, runs a big company, and it's not a game. And I said to him on the call in front of all of his employees, it's like, all right, let me put it this way. I think the gravy train of bullies getting away with murder is over. Because even the bullies right now don't get fucking seen. Even the bullies right now, Harvey Weinstein would not be able to make money at the box office right now. So, and since that time is over, the methods of treating everyone like shit don't work. So I'm not going to put up with it. And you're going to stop. And you're going to be accountable for everything that you do. You're not going to get away with some fucking bullshit statements that are lies, flat out lies, in order to serve yourself. That stuff is over. And so we're going to put them in the contract, and you're going to make sure that, you know, things change. And we changed the contract. And he had to apologize in front of his own employees. It's the first time anyone had ever heard this person say sorry in his life. And that's where we're at right now. Like, just lead with honesty, authenticity, and that gives you power and strength. Even when shit is down. And since the waves are all crashing down around us, let's surf.
Yeah, I completely agree. I suspect we have never had more solidarity in this industry. Or I would posit perhaps we might want to start calling ourselves a collective of creatives. And, you know, that has a nice little side effect of perhaps sidelining some of the people making the decisions that are, you know, more or less getting us in the mess that we are in the first place. Because the people who make this art, which are video games, are largely, we are all creatives, you know? Even programmers, etc. I'd absolutely, if you are a programmer working on a video game, bringing a vision to life, like, you are a creative. You are seeing something that does not exist in the world and bringing it into being, that is creating. We are creatives who have been captured by the modes of capitalism, by the holders of capitalism, and we have allowed their language in the form of things like IP and, you know, content to usurp the language of artists that we have been using. We have, you know, allowed their perspectives to dominate the conversation, their concerns to dominate our conversations. We spend as much time talking about profitability as, you know, the suits do these days. Like, that's these, and, you know, they're still important conversations to have. We need to engage with why things aren't working. And part of that means breaking down, you know, like, what are the modes of destruction that have led us to this moment in time. But yeah, we need to claim and reclaim our language and the way that we're looking at each other, the way that we are treating each other. And, you know, I would say we have, you know, from my slight experience, my slight duration in this industry, I haven't really experienced developers, creatives who make games being at odds with each other on the ground. I find this an incredibly supportive, large group of people. But we need to really identify and recognize and claim this solidarity. And I know this is a clarion call going out across all modes and all communities right now. You know, we talk about unionizing, etc. I will, you know, throw my voice into the linguistics of the problem. I'll say, as you have been advocating for as well, Jörg, with your constant calls to stop calling these goddamn games content, but to go back to, you know, acknowledging them as art. We need to reclaim our own view of ourselves. We need to stop being developers. We need to stop being creatives again. We need to recognize that that is our value. That is what we bring to the world. We are not just cogs in a machine. We are people who bring dreams to life. And it's not in the interests of capital to have us think about ourselves like that. Whether, you know, by whether they're doing it intentionally or not, the fact remains that we have allowed ourselves to be diminished, to be gaslit about our place and our role and our value in this process of game making. I would say enough, you know. I recently found out that my favorite game of all time, Gabriel Knight 1, was made in 1 year. 1 year. Something that changed, like, very literally the course of my life forever. We can all aspire to that. We can all create beautiful artworks of these games that change lives, that move us, that create community. It is within our hands. We've simply allowed the blurt of capital and the irrational expectations of, you know, the producers and executives to gaslight us into thinking that the only people who can really make really successful games and games that mean anything, The only people who can do that are the people who hold the checkbooks, who can write the big checks, who can fund their 6-7 years of development. And it's all a lie. This is Emperor's New Clothes shit. And, you know, I completely agree. I think that this is our collective reckoning. And we're realizing and we're remembering who we are instead of allowing other people to tell us who we are and what our value is. And this is a really powerful time for that. In fear and struggle, people rediscover what is important to them and, you know, what the value in life is, what we really care about once everything's stripped away.
I love this. You know, we have to wrap this up soon, but firstly, I think the one thing that we have to remind ourselves of, and the thing that makes games such an incredible piece of art form, and allows it to create such incredible pieces of art, and we haven't even seen the potential of what games can do yet. We really haven't. We've touched upon with games such as Gabriel Knight, with Eco, with Tetris. We have all touched upon the things that make them special. But now, with all that we've learned and gathered, everything that we're now capable of doing, like, I'm incredibly psyched. But the one thing that I think brings all those things together is, I think, the universal language, which I believe games are. I think far more than music, far more than literature. Literature is bound to translation if you want to bring it to other cultures. Music, some people might not vibe with jazz, you know. And the other thing is also different species will not respond to those forms of communication. However, play is something that you can do with anything and anyone. Like, you can play with your cat. You can play with a toddler, with a baby, with your plant, the way you direct it towards the sun and the way you make it interact with the space around you. Play is the universal language. That is what we all speak. And we move away from it. We allow people to destroy our ability to play and to engage the world in a playful manner. I believe that games are the thing that can bring that back to all of us and to remind us all that this is how we commit, this is how we bring joy and delight and the most beautiful, pure form of communication between human beings and other species and the world itself. We've completely turned our backs on Mother Earth completely to a point where we're not playing with it. We're not playing along. And if we start playing with it, it responds in the most beautiful ways. And so we have a lot of shit to do. And that's also part of the reason why there have been, or the main reason why there have been no directional episodes for the last couple of months or 3 months or so. And so one thing we will do is we were going to change the format a little bit, aren't we? Chan and I, you know, we're going to tune in with each other once a month. So you're guaranteed to have one directional a month of Chantal and I talking.
Aren't you lucky?
So you can get this free of charge once a month. And then we're going to gradually record tiny little seasonal packages of incredible people gathering around common themes.
Little volumes.
I like that.
Like a book.
Yes.
Or a series of books, Rob.
So look out for those. They won't be coming quickly because we've got shit to do. But but hopefully you can stick with us and reach out to us on all the different channels. And thank you for listening. And please surf with us. You know, things are dark. Sure. Things are falling apart. Sure. But it's not your problem. Our problem is to make beautiful things on top of all of that. While the system is crumbling, finally allow us to work together and to step on top of it and to build something better. And something that's not done in the name of money, but done in the name of culture and expression and joy and play.
And Like, follow, subscribe.
Like, follow, subscribe.
On that note, capitalism.
Yeah, we should have like a Patreon and ask people for money now. Crap, we're so bad at this. Anyway, love you all. Thanks for tuning in. And see you next month at the latest. Goodbye.
Later.
The theme song was composed by Oliver Krauss and Frally Hines. Follow us on Twitter @directionalshow and listen to past episodes at directional.show. See you next time.